Hey folks, Rhea here. Before we get to the episode, just wanted to let you know that my 2022 dates for the Fundraising Accelerator are up. The first one starts February 18th. So if you need to raise more money from individuals, specifically from major gift individuals, this is for you. Do you need to raise more money in 2022? Duh, obviously. My students experience regularly anywhere from 10 to 40x growth on their initial investment. That's right, I said 40. That's not even a mistake. So check out riawong.com for more details, and I'm offering early bird pricing before January 31st. See you there. Welcome to Nonprofit Lowdown. I'm your host, Rhea Wong.
Hey, listeners, it's Rhea Wong with you once again with Nonprofit Lowdown. Today, we are talking with my dear friend, Christine Lai, about money, power, and influence in the nonprofit world. So this is going to be a wide-ranging and fun conversation, obviously very thought-provoking. So before we get into it, I just want to introduce my friend Christine. I was really struggling with how to introduce you because you do a lot of different things. As they would say, you're a multi-hyphenate. And the way that I think about Christine is she's just sort of out there in the world creating opportunities, connections, and happiness for people, whether that's for-profits, not-for-profits, individuals. You're just like a creative good things in the world. So welcome, Christine.
Thanks, Rhea. It's nice to be here with you and everyone else today.
So before we get into it, help me understand a little bit about your background and what you've described as the best job in the world, because I think it's a little bit hard to understand because you do a lot of different things, but just so folks can kind of ground themselves in what it is you do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, thanks. Great question. And I feel very grateful. I mean, I feel hopefully people are kind of living their best jobs, and I kind of describe it as like the culmination of my life's work at this stage in my career. But I feel like I've always kind of been guided by the question, where's the opportunity to do the greatest good? And I feel really fortunate to have had dream career after dream career in sports and education and entertainment and hospitality and organizational culture. And the past few years, when people are like, Christine, what do you actually do? I'm like, I feel like I fell into this space of like funders, foundations, and the future. And I think in terms of kind of like how I show up in the world or what I do, when people are like, what do you actually do? I kind of joke at this stage, whenever I get a phone call, I'm like, I just want to be upfront. I don't want to waste anyone's time. I'm unhireable, not employable, and I have no interest in being a consultant, contractor, freelancer. I'm stoked to be a team member. So if that makes sense, I'm happy to continue chatting. And if not, I'm happy to listen and help figure out who your next best person is. Because I think right now, when the world is so complex and interdependent, for folks who can and choose to be free agents, who work in between the institutions and the organizations and the initiatives and projects, thinking about the collective and what benefits the many versus just the few. We can hopefully do that because that's what we need right now. And so, yeah, I mean, in terms of what I actually do, I think a lot of what I do is like relationships, partnerships, trying to figure out people's kind of like self-interest and motivations and figuring out what they're willing to generously contribute to make that happen and then connect the dots between individuals and organizations and communities and teams.
I'm getting some words that are coming to me right now, and the words are psychic air traffic controller.
I haven't heard it that way before, but I appreciate that. Like air traffic control, telephone operator.
Yeah, you're like, yes. You should go over there. You over here. Okay, all joking aside, we wanted to have this conversation because you do have experience with foundations and VCs. And I'm just wondering, just to start off with, I think that we often in the nonprofit world kind of absorb this notion of like pitches and being in the VC space. And I think there's also this bias that somehow like for-profit or corporate is more efficient or better than nonprofits. So my question to you is, what can the for-profit and not-for-profit world learn from each other, and what can we unlearn from each other?
What a great question. And I've been asking that similar question kind of like with venture capital and philanthropy, because I think hopefully like we're all trying our best and doing our best, and we're just hopefully learning with each other. One of the groups and an individual that I work with, a very dear friend, Evan Steiner, he's been helping to try to shift folks from impact and outcomes to learning. Because if we kind of like think about what impacts and outcomes are, it's kind of already centering, like we have an idea of what we think the solution is versus actually there's like a collective opportunity that everyone holds a different piece of the puzzle. And so how are we actually sharing all of our learnings together? And so I think in terms of like what for-profits and nonprofits can learn and unlearn from each other, I think there's a lot of like processes and systems and structures that have been refined in the for-profit world for profitability? And how are those things actually revalued in some ways to actually think about the commons versus just one organization or one business? And so I think nonprofits do a really good job of that in terms of thinking about the collective, thinking about the community, what's in service of like the bigger picture. And so being able to kind of share those values, those best practices, those principles, I think are one of the ways that for-profits and nonprofits can learn and unlearn from each other.
Okay, so I think the genesis of this conversation, even though we talk about a lot of things, is this idea that with donors in particular, that because they have money, because they may write big checks, they have more power and more influence in the ways in which nonprofits do business. And I also see that perhaps playing out within the VC world. If they're making a significant investment in a company, they get to determine the ways in which things happen. So I'm curious, sort of broadly, bigger picture, how do we shift from this idea of like we are beholden to the people who have money to we are in partnership and we are in learning space?
Yes. So this is, and again, only in the past few years have I kind of gotten into this foundation space. So my kind of limited perspective and what I've been able to observe is I think foundations oftentimes have a vision of the world that they want to see possible, which is awesome. I think the challenging part is that they want to fund that and make those things possible, and then organizations mission drift to that. Versus there's a foundation that I work with and just kind of like flip that. So instead of kind of like being the center of it, they're creating a container where they've identified practitioners who are on the ground in community doing work and building relationships with folks, and then identified the organizations who support them. And the role of the foundation is actually to de-risk those experiments and prototypes to create sustainable like revenue for those organizations to continue existing so they can support those practitioners on the ground. They have a different flywheel. And so how do we encourage and invite funders and foundations and others to decenter themselves and then actually create a container for the activity they want to see with the individuals, the communities, the nonprofit organizations? And so hopefully that helps in terms of like a very structural way of like decentering and then creating a container.
So, but how do we do that? Because I think we've talked, especially like post George Floyd's murder, this idea of decentering whiteness, decentering power, and centering work and centering communities of color at the core. I'm curious if you've seen any examples of how that is done. And conversely, I shouldn't ask you more than one question at once, but also like recognizing that if you are a person of power that has traditionally been at the center, like, how do you get people to give power up and share power? Like, that's sort of fundamentally the question, because you can't center something else if someone is still in the center and not sharing.
Yeah. So the first part, and remind me, because I know there's a two-part question. So the first part, at least from a tangible and hopefully more tactical kind of what we do, I always encourage funders. I think there's three main things. There's obviously a slew of things that they can do, but the three main things that they can do, obviously they fund things. Then they also convene, because their invitation is oftentimes more powerful to bring different stakeholders together than other invitations. And then they also have to map things. They have to make things visible, because there's very few instances where an individual and organization is incentivized to make activity visible. And so how might funders or foundations create that map, create that visibility to even see who's doing what, to then coordinate those efforts and then maybe even identify opportunities to collaborate? And so on the latter part, in terms of how do you even start to decenter yourself or even go through that process of it, it's kind of like, well, first and foremost, individually, do we have the awareness, the ability, and the interest to do that? And then I think for me, like, I'm always like, the very baseline is like relationships. It's like, who are you? And like, do we even like each other? Do we have shared values? And how do we get to know each other? I love to do that over like shared meals. But just being able to understand, instead of saying like, what do you do? Asking, who are you? And being able to start from a very human place where at the end of the day, we're two humans who need to eat and we have things that we're thinking about. So how do we create a space for those conversations to happen? And it just takes time. And I think that's the challenging part right now, is that we're so eager and so anxious. And I also acknowledge like me saying that is already coming from a place of luxury and privilege of saying we need more time. And so I hear you as like, how do we tend to that go slow to go fast, and also things need to happen now, but then there's going to be some things that take the next 20, 30 plus years to actually happen.
I love what you say about the creation of space and the invitation to actually get to know people as people, because I think so often, and as you know, my work is with fundraisers, but I feel like a lot of fundraisers step into conversations with people who may have a lot of wealth with, number one, a lot of preconceived notions about who that person is and what they're like based on their income bracket. And then two, coming with this idea of like they have to pitch rather than connect. And I'm wondering if you could speak about that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a lot of maybe society's kind of what they've shown us is possible, right? People like love to network. And it's kind of like, okay, well, when we come to network, it's kind of like, who are you? What can I get from you? Like, what's the exchange here? Versus like thinking about it from a relationship perspective of saying like, you're a human that has come into my life and we've crossed paths, trust the universe. And like, why are we meant to have this conversation? Like, what's possible here? And this is kind of like borrowed from like Meg Wheatley. She often says like, what's possible here and who cares? And so imagine having a conversation from that perspective of saying like, hey Rhea, who are you? Like, what's top of head and heart for you in this moment? And then how do I relate to that? And then how do I share with you some of the things that are top of head and heart for me to be able to even have that space? And so I think oftentimes we are, like you said, we have preconceived notions of who people are. And if we don't even give them the space, like show up as who they are versus like who they represent or the money that part of their inheritance or whatever the case may be, like it already creates that wall. But how do we actually create a more neutral space to just actually be human and actually like listen and care about one another?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you said that, because I think sometimes when I first started fundraising, I didn't know that the quote unquote best practice was to go in with like a pitch. So I just went in with like good questions. I was like, I'm a human, you're a human, let's just talk about the human things. And in retrospect, it's almost like it was good that I didn't know what best practice was, because it actually opened up space to just have a human conversation.
Exactly. And I think one thing that you're also sharing that's making me think too, because I think it's almost a dual responsibility, like the person who's like looking for support, funding, all that kind of stuff. And then people who are the ones funding ideas or funding things. It's kind of like both sides need to be able to kind of let their guards down, because sometimes some people on the funding side are like, just tell me what you need. And they're moving at 100 miles per hour. And so I think it's often really helpful. I've described it as like having a transfer of trust or having an introduction or having someone who actually helps create that connection, that folks actually lower their guard a bit, because otherwise people are so used to showing up in a certain way or people coming to them a certain way, and they don't have that invitation or space to be like, wow, here's another awesome human that I want to connect with, that I need to connect with. And so, yeah, both sides need to also be able to let that guard down to then create that space for the us versus, yeah, what is it that you need? What is it that you want?
Yeah, I love that, because I talk so often in my training about moving from the transactional to the relational. Yes. If you've been networked, it feels terrible, actually. You're like, oh, so you just reached out to me to like have these conversations in order to get something from me, and vice versa.
Yeah.
That's not a place of like generosity and generation.
Well, even right now, I mean, even before we jumped on this call, you were asking me, is one of your superpowers connecting people? And I was kind of like, oh, like not really. Actually, I think one of my superpowers is like seeing the best in people and getting to be their champion and cheerleader and then being able to then make the connection. So it's kind of a little bit of an order of operations of that nuance there.
So one of the things that I really appreciate about you, Christine, is it feels like you're kind of an old soul. It feels like you've lived many lifetimes before. And it feels like you have sort of this belief in the abundance of the universe, and that like everything is fine and everything is meant to be the way it's supposed to be, which I think is incredibly inspiring. And for people like myself, it feels a little bit like, oh, can that really be true? So talk to me a little bit about like, why is that? Is that, were you just born this way, or are there specific steps that you took to be able to trust in the abundance of the universe?
Yeah, this is such a fun question, Rhea. And I oftentimes, and folks have heard me talk about this before, it's kind of like I give a lot of appreciation and gratitude to my previous lives for having done a lot of the hard work to pass the baton to me to live this life. And I think about life like we're living this life of this much larger life. And so all I meant to do is X, right? Like build community, figure out some stuff with ecosystem development, hopefully make progress and make the world hopefully a better place than I came into it, to pass the baton to my next life. And I also recently, with a lot of things that have been happening in the world, I also kind of added, like, I also cannot rob my future life of a lesson that it's meant to learn. And so how do we take that legacy and pressure off our shoulders of like this life but know that it's a much larger thing. And we're just trying to do our best and show up the best way that we can to honor what's gotten us here, and then also to set our future selves up for success. And one of the phrases, I have a practice of taking like sabbaticals, and this phrase from this last sabbatical is opt-in, which stands for open, patient, trusting. And so to the notion of the universe, it's like, how do we be open as like who shows up, how they show up, when they show up? How do we be patient with ourselves and the process? And then how do we trust that everything is happening for us, not to us? And if we're able to approach, I think, many things in life, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a work opportunity, whether it's anything that's happening, if we acknowledge that things are happening for us and not to us, how do we then show up in that situation? Acknowledging how do we move forward with this with a new learning or with a new insight or with a new relationship or a new opportunity.
I love that so much. And I might use different words, but I think a lot about energy and the energy that we show up with. And I think,
yes,
especially in the nonprofit world, I think we show up with that scarcity energy, like that sort of mindset of like gripping and, oh, if I don't like get this gift, like it's all over for us, as opposed to calming down and just really being present in the moment and trusting that like whatever needs to happen will happen, and what won't happen happens because it's not meant to happen.
Yeah, totally. It's just like also this, when you're sharing, oh, keep going.
Oh, I'm just going to say like, that's just like a tremendous like leap of faith.
Yes. Well, I think one of the other things when we were kind of jamming on some stuff before, the whole notion of just value. And I love, especially like in careers, but I think it also can apply to nonprofits and funding. I love to ask people like who deserves to work with you, your like uniqueness of like the relationships you built, the experience that you have, the things that you've invested in, and who deserves that. I think very similarly on the fundraising side with nonprofits, like who deserves to fund you? Hopefully you're working with an organization that you are so proud of and so committed to that you are excited to like figure out who are the best funders who have the opportunity to fund you, versus the scarcity mindset that you're talking about of like, I would need money for sustainability, which is very true at the same time. So I understand like both are true. And I think really being clear and discerning with to like, who gets the opportunity to fund the things that we're working on in the world, to ensure values alignment, to make sure you have the right funding for patient long cap, like long-term capital, whatever the case may be. And then trusting that the right people, the right opportunities, the right conversations will happen, and really kind of shifting your mindset and energy towards that, I think kind of changes the way that you even approach a conversation when it comes to quote unquote fundraising.
I love that so much because I'm really on this one woman mission to change the way that we think about fundraising, particularly around this notion of donors. I'd really like us to shift from donors to partners. So you had a really interesting point about partnerism. Can you talk to us about partnerism?
Yeah, so that's actually a thing from Rianne Eisler. She's an incredible author, economist, and she has a few books out actually. One of the latest ones is Nurturing Our Humanity, and she talks about partnering versus domination. And so a lot of this, I think we're conditioned, or in the capital society, we're used to this dominating, like I have more, you have less, whatever the case may be, versus figuring out how to partner, because hopefully us both coming together creates more. It's like, hopefully what's good for me is what's good for you is what's good for us, or acknowledging what my needs are, acknowledging your needs, and then figuring out how do we create something that hopefully is good for both of us, or more of us versus just a few.
You know, I was thinking about this morning. When we think about people who have great material wealth, I think often what we don't realize is that they are in search of something that money can't buy, which is purpose and transformation and self-actualization. And so what I'm wondering, could you talk a little bit about what is it that you have observed that folks with great wealth are looking for in social impact partnerships and ventures?
Yeah, I think it kind of goes back to what we talked about at the beginning, and like this understanding what people care about. Because I think the challenging part is like money is it's one form of value. It's one thing that I think people put a lot of weight on, and that oftentimes kind of intertwines with people's identity. But when you actually kind of get down to like what people care about, when you especially think about social impact, it's like, well, why do you care about, like, what is your story as like why that has become such an important thing that you want to support or that you want to fund? And then how do we then find the right organization to deserve that opportunity to do so? And so I think what's challenging is that, again, it kind of goes back to what we talked about around like the the notion of being able to come back to the human part of like why we care about things versus that transactional piece, like what you talk about, like moving from the transaction back to the relational. I think with high net worth and with social impact, a lot of things get convoluted and you don't kind of get back to like the nexus of the heart of like where that first came from, whether it was like the care or the interest or the hope or the belief. And so I think in terms of what gets in the way is kind of, we don't, again, create that space, that invitation for that story to really take forefront versus just the money and the power and the things that it can give you that we think it can give you. There's just much more of an opportunity when we actually get back to the core nexus of like why we care about the things that we care about and then why we want to fund them and support them. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah. So two more questions and then I'd love to open it up to the audience. Let's talk about money for a second, because people are weird about money. There's a lot about money. And so I talk about this in my trainings, but like it's literally a piece of paper and we make it mean so many things. We tell so many stories about it, whether we have enough or don't have enough or had a lot growing up or didn't have a lot growing up. And I think to your point, money is just a resource like anything else. Why is it, do you think, that we have such an emotional reaction to money in the way that we don't have emotional reactions to other things?
The first thing that come up for me is that people have the stories they tell themselves around the role of money and the importance of money and the significance of money. And then there's a lot of things that are traumas in our lives of like how we were raised or how money showed up, has shown up in our lives in ways that have been explicit or informally. And so I think I don't even know if I know how to really approach that question per se, because I thought there's so many other layers of like well-being around money that I don't know the history of money that well, in the sense of saying like at what point do those things become at odds versus being more integrated with one another. So yeah, that's a fascinating question. I'd love to like dive into it more with some other people that I think would have some really awesome, more fact-based things on it. For me, it's more so like the feeling. And I feel like there's so many different things of the stories we tell ourselves and the experiences we had with how money has shown up in our lives.
All right. Maybe that was an unfair question, but let's flip that, because I think one of the things that I notice and appreciate about you is that you're very intentional about language. And I think the language that we use shapes our perspectives and experiences. So, I mean, I talk about this again. So in the world of like, my board isn't raising enough money, even attaching the word yet to the end of that sentence changes your whole perspective about it. So I'm wondering, can you talk to me about the ways in which you are intentional about using language in order to shape your reality?
Yeah, anyone who's in conversations with me hopefully like knows how much I am a proponent of like framing and language. And it's one of those things where like when we're saying it, not only are others hearing it, but we're also hearing it. And so we hear ourselves the most all day, every day. And so the language that we use, I mean, even like little things, like when people are like, oh my gosh, I'm so busy. I'm like, I invite you, it feels good to use the word full instead. And it's just all around, like we're so conditioned and moving so fast. How do we make sure that we're being really mindful to the words that we're using, the things that we're describing, because we're hearing that first and foremost. And then we're also kind of like propagating them in the world. And so I think language is such a huge thing. There's so many different examples of how I like reframe and language things, but it is a huge part of what I think we can hopefully be mindful to. And I kind of joke, it's kind of like, what's your relationship with your inner roommate? Hopefully it's a positive one. And that's how you actually start to work and repattern and relearn the language that may not have fully served us and what may serve us more moving forward.
Can you give us an example? I think it would help people to kind of ground in like tactical things.
Yeah. So the busy and full is a big one in terms of like people just saying like, my life is so busy or my schedule is so busy. And it's kind of like, why are we busy doing the right things? And so I invite folks to use the word full, because like I'm intentionally, hopefully my life is very full with the things that I want to make it full with. And so even that slight language shift, I think can also feel differently, both for me saying it, but also hopefully for the person who's hearing that and receiving that as well.
Yeah, that's so powerful. And I'm just thinking about it in like the nonprofit context. So as the executive director, I was not necessarily aware that on top of the things that I was saying, everything that I did would also be interpreted and magnified, like such as the nature of leadership. Like I saw myself just like, I'm just, you know, one of the guys in the trenches, and everything I did was interpreted. And so when I said things like, oh, we don't have enough money for that, or we can't afford that, or like, blah, 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 I'm worried about X, Y, or Z in the next quarter, it not only reaffirmed my own sense of scarcity, but it also affirmed for everybody around me, my staff, my board, of, oh, we don't have enough money. And like our leader is not actually helping us to look and reframe it in a different way.
Well, like, even like little things, like people when people say like, no worries, like instead of saying no worries, I say all good. Or when people say like, don't rush, I'm like, well, just take your time. It's like even those really slight different things, because it's kind of like positive parenting. It's like, you don't want to tell your kids not what to do. You want to tell your kids what to do. So like provide people with an alternative option. And that also kind of opens things up. It's kind of like the improv practice of instead of saying but, say yes and. And so how do we build upon things and like create more space for other things to show up versus shutting things down and saying, nope, that's like not here. Like, nope, that's not possible. And it kind of shuts down our creativity. It shuts down the ways that we think about things. And so how do we hopefully continuously open up more space for things that we may not even know needs to be part of the conversation, be part of the conversation.
This is my last question before I open it up. Let's talk about white space, because I've been thinking a lot about the value of white space. And coming out of the pandemic, like, there was a lot of white space there, but it was sort of fraught with anxiety. My question to you is, what is the value of white space in conversations, at the same time knowing that we want to be intentional about how we're spending our time? Like, and are these two things intention?
My brain goes in like several different threads. So maybe I'll say a couple of things if you want to reflect back so I can refine the direction that would be most interesting or valuable. I mean, when you think about white space, I think about, again, I mentioned briefly, like I have a practice of taking life sabbaticals. And I think it's really important to create space and time in our lives and our careers to be able to like be intentional as to like how and where we're investing our energy or attention and our time. I also think about white space even in like these Zoom worlds, like the white space in between calls, like, or not in between calls, but like even in between comments of like, if you're in a group with like 20 people and then there's like no one saying anything. Like sometimes I like holding that space, and I kind of joke sometimes to break the ice, kind of like the eye gazing portion of the call. But sometimes just being able to create things like let an idea land or like let someone kind of like have space to think, like those white spaces I think are invaluable, because if we kind of move so fast that we move past the idea that was just sitting there right below the surface, then missing an idea or an opportunity. And again, you trust that that wasn't the right place and time for it. But the more that we're able to create white space, whether it be in conversations or whether it be in our lives every day, you never know what might show up. And again, that's also being comfortable and confident in being with ourselves and allowing that white space to be, because we don't always have to fill things with time. Again, it goes back to the notion of being busy too in some ways. It's kind of like, I need to fill every moment of every day to be the most effective and efficient person as possible. But are all those things really helping that? And so I think even like right now, when you mentioned this white space in this kind of like COVID world that we're in, it's kind of like, are we moving so fast from like, we're human beings, not human doings. And so how do we acknowledge and appreciate and value the beingness as much as the doingness? Because sometimes just being is enough. Just showing up is enough. And how do we value that? And how do we be okay with that as long as we continue to do that work inside ourselves? That was a very weird note to end on, but hopefully that makes sense and lands with folks.
Yeah, to me, it goes back to this notion of scarcity, right? Because scarcity can also show up in time scarcity, right? So if our belief is 1,000%. Like, there's not enough time and blah, 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 and like I'm like frantic all the time, that doesn't actually create the right sort of energy and space and time to be, but also to have conversations in which we are truly present. Because if we're always like thinking about the next thing, you're not really here.
Yes, 1,000%. I mean, to be super honest right now, and I've mentioned this to some colleagues and collaborators and friends recently, I haven't felt this time constraint, Rhea, in a very long time. Like I designed my life for spaciousness, and the way that the world is right now, I'm like, wow, it's going back to 100 miles per hour. And I know for myself, I'm best when I'm cruising around 70. And so I'm in this like my own personal process of trying to calibrate and integrate, like, how do I respond and be supportive and show up to the things that need my attention, energy, and time? And how do I also honor like the quality of that in the best way that I think I can show up to be of service to the individuals or organizations or teams that I work with? And so that's my own process. So I'm like literally in it again right now. And it's like a constant learning refinement process always.
Okay, I want to dig into this because it's so interesting. You said design your life. And I think that notion is so powerful. Like, conceptually, I only really thought about it when I read the book Designing Your Life. And I was like, oh, that's right. You can actually design your life on purpose. You can make decisions about how you want your life to be and the time that you spend on things and the activities that you do and the people that you interact with. And it was like such a mind shift for me. I was like, wait, what? I mean, I'm in charge of my life. Talk to me about how you design your life and what sort of decisions you make. And then maybe tactically, like, how can people start to think about designing their own lives?
Yeah. And thanks for that question. I almost in some ways want to take it in a different direction, just because I know a lot of folks kind of on these calls are focused around like nonprofits and things like that. But one of the last organizations that I worked with, we focused on culture. And we always say, like, you have a culture by design or a culture by default. And so I think, and it's challenging because I think in the nonprofit space, and I'm happy to go into like the actual personal practical tactics of things, but in the nonprofit space, my understanding or my experience has been that a lot of our time is from external factors, like our funder needing a report and then the funder needing that report because our board needs that report. And it's kind of like, how do we actually get to the underlying reasons as to like why we are doing these things? Because is it, again, to keep us busy or is it to actually create things of value? And I think for us, like until we actually kind of draw a line in the sand and be clear with boundaries and expectations and being clear with that, can we ask the question of our funders or of our team or of our leadership, like, why are we going through these exercises if it feels like it's not actually of value and it's just keeping us busy? And so I think in terms of the notion of like designing your life, like for me, I try a few times a year, at the very least once a year, to actually look at my year and be like, how was this year? And was it more by design or was it more by default? And then what are the one or two things that I can incrementally kind of change or kind of refine and do differently to hopefully, again, be more intentional with, again, all my attention, energy, and time. And I think it's also not just an individual thing, it's a community thing. Because if we think about this from an individual's perspective, which we're very socialized to do, there is a time scarcity. But then when you start thinking about it from a more community collective perspective, there's so much more to play with. Anyway, that's like a whole other thread of conversation, but hopefully that was a few.
Let's make sure to put some time on the calendar to have another conversation about life design, because I think it's super fascinating. But the thing that you said that I think was really interesting is I know you're involved with the READY. And one of the things I like to talk about is culture is read only. It's really the habits that undergird the culture. And so I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about that, because I think I've been in situations where people are like, okay, we're going to change the culture, but there's no real examination of all of the habits and practices underneath the culture that actually support the culture, right? So it's like, you can't change the culture until you change the habit. Say a little bit more about that, and then I will open it up for questions.
It's almost like two sides of the same coin. I think, I mean, the READY and then also Delivering Happiness, one of the other organizations I've worked with in the past, we often say, okay, you can have your values that are like on a cool poster on a wall, but then how do you actually get to what they mean, like in actions and behaviors? And so whenever we work with teams or whenever I work with teams on kind of like values and behaviors, it's kind of like, okay, great, let's get to the principle or the value that we want to live. And then how do they show up in our lives? And then how are we practicing them and how are we living them? And then how are we also giving each other kudos or feed forward on how to refine them? Because like you said, it is this kind of like, it's like a muscle. Like the more that we exercise it, the stronger it gets, hopefully the more it can serve us. And that shows up with values and that shows up with our actions and behaviors. Like I think for me, at a certain point, hopefully your values just are so embedded in you that it doesn't have to be an additional thing that you think about. It's just hopefully authentic and genuine and part of just who you are and how you show up in the world. And so the more that we're able to do that, both for ourselves first and foremost, but then with the teams that we work with, can we then actually start to change our habits and behaviors? Because then we're actually experiencing like, how am I living these values or what can I do better that would be helpful to you? Or how are you experiencing it? And so if we're able to create spaces and opportunities for those conversations and just those quick reflections, can we hopefully then, like you're saying, build on those layers of our actions, our behaviors, how we're living our values, how we're showing up in the world, and making that an easeful process versus one where we're like going through the motions of like, how are we living our values, like kind of thing. It's kind of like making it fun and making it just embedded as part of our practice of even just moving and thinking in the world.
Okay, I totally lied. This is actually my last question. Okay, let's talk about happiness for a second, because I've reflected a lot on happiness. So a big part of happiness for me is being able to determine my own schedule. But I'm wondering, is the goal happiness or is the goal being of service and having purpose? But I'd be curious, since you literally worked for a company called Delivering Happiness, what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, and this is also in the book about this a little bit, but in the notion of happiness is a state. And so it's kind of these fleeting moments of happiness versus you're talking about purpose or you're talking about other things. It's kind of there's a more sustainable kind of long-term path, and those things will change and grow, but there's going to be moments of happiness. And so I think I'm a big option C, give me both, right? I want to be happy in living my purpose. And so I think being able to understand what are the things that give you joy or happiness, but a lot of that is an infusion of a moment or an infusion of something. And so I think purpose is, again, the foundational kind of element that allows you to have moments of happiness and hopefully more moments of happiness versus you're trying to figure out what the purpose is. It kind of feels like it's off kilter sometimes. And so there might not be as many moments of happiness. And so I feel like purpose is a huge foundation towards having more moments of happiness versus less.
Awesome. I'm going to do what you told me to do and give a little bit of white space here for people to respond, because I think we threw out a lot of really interesting concepts, some of which was power, money, and influence, but I feel like we went a little bit on a walkabout, and that's okay. Let's do a little U-turn here and talk about money and influence and power. Are we able to decouple these three ideas? Because I feel like so often, especially in Western culture, the world that we live in, the US 2021, these three things are very much entwined. If I have money, that means I have power, that means I have influence. And I think in part it is the ways in which we value money as the meta resource. So my question is, can we decouple these things? And if so, what might that look like?
Yeah, it's so funny because if we were just having a conversation with everyone in this room, I would almost I love being able to pose questions back. And because I'm a big believer, yes, hopefully many things are possible. One of the phrases I use is we have to model what's needed to create what's possible. And so how might we model and experiment with the decoupling of influence, money, and power? And what might that look like? And I feel like I have one perspective, you have one perspective. Folks who are listening in or kind of tuning in or also have many perspectives. And so for me, it's kind of the collective brain trust of how do we actually do that? And it is a societal thing, because somehow we have put on a pedestal money, and then we put on a pedestal that along with that comes power, and that along with that comes influence. I think as often as we have done that on a pedestal, we're also able to take that down. We've seen that with cancel culture. We've seen that with so many other things, how society, how a collective, how community can change the narrative. And so my hope is, yes, we can absolutely decouple them. As to how, I feel like there's a lot of hearts and minds in this conversation, but also in the world that can think about that. How do we, again, create that space and that container, that invitation to think about ways to do that? And I think even for us in the ways that, again, a lot of folks, I think with the intention of this call was coming to this about fundraising, it's kind of how do we, in our process of fundraising, decouple the influence and the money and the power? And how do we just call it out and have a conversation about it? And I think in even talking about it, do we then start creating a space for it, for them to us think about what the experiments could be, for them to us to start doing that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting invitation for folks, which is how can we be explicit about these three different things, because they're not the same thing, even though we often sort of conflate them in our minds and talk about them independently of each other. And even just to become aware of the assumptions that we make about money, power, and influence is a first step. And it's funny, I was talking to a friend of mine about this iceberg notion and sort of root causes. And I was like, is there ever not a point at which all roads lead to white supremacy? Why do we have any cause? White supremacy. Why don't we have resources in the hands of the communities? White supremacy. And so, all right, this will be my last question for you, which is, I think certainly in the last couple of years, we are having much more explicit conversations around the notion of social justice, community, white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism in ways that we haven't before. I guess The challenge that I have, and I'd be curious about your thoughts, is we have a lot of conversations around what we don't want it to be, but there aren't very many models of what we do want it to be. And I'm curious about your thoughts about, like, how do we start to create a model of how it could be? Because it just feels like there's a lot of what it's not, but not what it actually is.
Yeah, the thing that comes to mind is one of the organizations that I get to work with, the way that they describe it is that they're working on the path towards a post-capital, or they're working towards a post-capital society on the path towards a protopian future. And one of the things that they're trying to do, they call it institutional experimentation. And I kind of simplify by calling it co-funding and being able to identify, like, who are the individuals, the organizations, the high net worth individuals, the foundations, the corporations who have the awareness, the ability, and the interest to decenter themselves and their money and power in the process of transitioning to the next system. And I think in terms of how do we even start doing that, we just have to experiment again. Like, it's kind of like all we can do is experiment and learn. That's what I hopefully do in my career, my life, is like I experiment with like life sabbaticals. I experiment with being a free agent. I experiment with XYZ things, but I can hopefully share those with you and other folks who are interested to inform and inspire them of the experiment that they can run. And so I think in terms of this notion around like how do we decenter things or how do we decouple things, like, again, we have to create space for the conversation and then we can see what energy, what interest arises for us to then be inspired or informed to create some experiments. And then hopefully we can identify folks who care about that, want to create that, have some resources to share, whether that's money, social connections, like whatever the case may be, for them to see what we have on the table to work with and then create an experiment. And so all of it is, I think, prototyping, and every day is an opportunity to do something different or something new. And so, yeah, I think just one day, one step at a time, and hopefully we have a chance to design that and be intentional with how we're spending our time towards that.
Do you think that we are on the precipice of a new global consciousness?
It's such an interesting question. I mean, isn't that hopefully the opportunity every day?
Perhaps, but I think it just feels like recent events in the world, both in the natural world and our political sphere, have really pushed the conversations further than I've ever seen it in my lifetime. And I just hope maybe we're on the verge of recognizing the true interdependence of all of us in the world. Or also totally. Maybe not. I mean, who knows?
I'm with you on the former train in terms of like this interdependence notion. And I think it's also one of those things where we can look in hindsight and things are more clear. But then when we look in the future, it's kind of like all ambiguous and not all there fully formed yet. And I think the hope is that, at least my hope or my understanding or my experience observation, is that we're constantly being able to kind of like create that and see that. And we also, again, have to have that patience that it's a much longer horizon. I don't know what people believe in or kind of like all that kind of stuff. But a friend was recently sharing with me, like, we're at the beginning of a very long, dark period. And actually our responsibility is not to F it up. We can't solve it, at least in our lifetime. And so how do we be okay with that? That's actually our part of the journey to hold that torch of. And again, that goes to our ego and our thinking about the ecosystem. It's kind of like sometimes things do need to get worse before they get better, which I know is a horrible thing to think about sometimes. And how do we, again, give things the most love and light to be able to not collapse fully on our watch and know that a lot of things are unraveling, unfolding that we may not even see or know in this moment. But in hindsight, hopefully, again, people talk about the seven generations. It's kind of like they can look back and be like, wow, well, whatever the case may be. But it's kind of like this global consciousness. I think we're constantly learning and seeing more things. And so hopefully we are becoming more conscious and understanding of how we're all connected and interdependent on and with each other for all the actions and things that we do and the things that we say and da 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 da.
Awesome. That's a beautiful note to end on. Christine, if folks want to get in touch with you, what would be the best way to connect?
Great question, because I'm not super active on social media. It's kind of like email or phone.
So can folks get in touch with you via LinkedIn?
Yeah, LinkedIn is great. And I think my cell phone and my email are both on there. So if I'm not super responsive, feel free to reach out via either of those.
All righty. Well, Christine, thanks so much. This has been so fun. And I know it was a very wide-ranging conversation, but hopefully folks got some value out of it and Awesome. Gave us a lot of things to think about. So thanks so much. Have a great day.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Rhea. Thanks, everyone. Have a good one.